to try to follow roughly the same outline for meditation every time. Mm. Sometimes we can go faster, mm. sometimes more slowly. Then. Or as always, try to devise that mindfulness, first of all, the clarity in the present moment. And one of the ways of doing that, again, is to give the sense of wonder at this wonderful opportunity that you have now to practice the meditation. Yeah. Most of us, we're ordinarily so busy in our ordinary lives. There's so many things to do, so many burdens in our lives. Our house, our family, our work, all of these things. And right now, you're free of all of that. All you have is yourself sitting here on this cushion. Have nothing to do in the whole world. What a wonderful thing that is. To feel that sense of freedom. Feel the sense of this precious opportunity that you have right now. mindfulness starts to arise, it is almost as if you feel that you are standing back from the world. The world is out here, right there, and you are in here just watching everything passing by on the screen of that mindfulness. It is as if the world cannot touch you anymore. You're just observing, allowing things to come and allowing things to pass away. There's no emotional reaction to these things, but just an awareness of what is going on. And when you get to that stage, then you know that your mindfulness is quite well established. Wish to take the meditation in a slightly different direction. And please only follow along if you feel comfortable about this. To start off by imagining yourself in a room, in a very simple room with walls all around it, no windows, all the walls, the ceiling, everything is white. And there's nothing in this room apart from the bed. And you are lying on that bed, on your back. There is a door and the door is closed. There's nothing in this room to catch your attention whatsoever. And as you are lying there, you know that you're coming to the end of your life. You know maybe you have an hour or two left. And you know that between now and the time of death, you will not meet anyone at all. Just feel what that feels like for a while. is that and you start to realize that you are going to have a, to let go of everything in your life. And the first thing that you have to let go of is all the possessions in your life. So the large possessions of your house or whatever it is, down to the most dearest possessions that you may possess in this life. All of that has to go. You realize there is no other way. So try to abandon that mentally. Let it all go. And feel the kind of freedom that arises from that. And as you are lying there, and the death is gradually approaching, you realize you also have to let go of all your family and all your friends. Now is the time in your mind to say your final goodbye, and to wish them well on their own path. Now is your time to take your own path and go your own way. Next, you realize that you have to give up pretty much all your identity. All your identity is so much tied to the things that you have been doing in this life. All that now is the past. All that is gone now. And you can basically say goodbye to your entire history. At the same time as you do that, you realize that the future, you don't know where you are going. You feel safe because you've been living a good life, but the future is still uncertain. It's like a blank screen. In a very real sense, you have no past and you have no future at this particular time. And if you feel right about this, you can feel how the mindfulness establishes itself in the present moment. Very close to your last moments. You're already feeling very light and at ease because you have let go of so much. The very last thing that you have to let go of on this passage is the body itself. Just feel what it feels like to free yourself of this heavy body and gradually move on into lightness. that as you do this, then there comes a point when you're not quite sure whether you are really dead or alive. And all you know is that you feel this wonderful sense of lightness and ease. And it's as if you have left so many burdens and so many problems behind you. You realize what a wonderful experience this is to move on in this way of lightness and beauty. And as you do that, you feel this tremendous sense of gratitude for your earthly existence. All the support, all the wonderful things you have been given, which now enable you to have this wonderful experience as you are saying your final goodbyes. As this sense of gratitude arises, at the very same time, you feel this enormous sense of metta and kindness to all the beings on the planet. You feel this arising out of the gratitude itself. And you wish them all well. You're moving into the unknown future. And as you do so, you wish all the beings and every one of you have. May you be well, may you be happy. To your breath again, and to stay with your breath for a few moments. that once again we are at the close to the end of the meditation. And once again review what has happened over the last half an hour or so, right? And try to see the causes and the effects of how the meditation actually progresses.
According to this recording and send it to the people who aren't.
Sure, yeah, why not? Yeah, good idea, yes.
Für die deutsche Übersetzung dieser Todesbetrachtung hatte ich mir gedacht, ich könnte es so machen, dass ich anhand dieser Aufnahme eine deutsche Aufnahme mache und wie diejenigen, die daran interessiert sind, kann ich dann das rundschicken. Wenn ihr vielleicht eine Liste macht und eure Namen eintragt, eure E-Mail-Adressen habe ich ja alle. Okay.
Okay, so here we get to the transmission. Question number one. Do you under the stream of consciousness you mentioned that goes from life to life? What is it in Pali? And the Pali word is Vijnana Sota. Vijnana is consciousness, Sota is stream. Quite literally means stream of consciousness. Is it the same as the Bhavanga in the Abhidhamma? Thank you. Well, probably not, because the Bhavanga is a particular type of consciousness. Yeah, that is kind of, it doesn't really exist in the suttas, it only exists in the Abhidhamma. So the ordinary stream of consciousness actually includes everything that we experience. It is not limited to a particular type of consciousness, but includes the whole stream, the whole waking stream. Whereas the Bhavanga is some kind of underlying consciousness that kind of is supposed to always be there and kind of drives you on from one life to the next one. So the Bhavanga is like an innovation of the Abhidhamma, whereas the stream of consciousness is really the early Buddhist term for this.
Der Strom des Bewusstseins, der von einem Leben zum nächsten geht, wie nennt sich das in Pali? Und ist es das gleiche wie Bhavanga im Abhidhamma? It was Vijnana Sota?
Yes, Vijnana Sota. Yeah.
Sota.
Yeah.
Okay, also das Pali-Wort heißt Vijnana Sota und heißt wirklich Strom des Bewusstseins und der Begriff Bhavanga ist quasi eine Erfindung des Abhidhamma. Das kommt in den frühen Texten nicht vor. Und während Vijnana Sota alles umfasst, was man erfahren kann, ist Bhavanga eine spezielle Art von Bewusstsein, die als ein zugrunde liegendes Bewusstsein beschrieben wird, das von einem Leben zum anderen weitergeht.
Okay, so next one, dear Ajahn Mali, why do habits tend to get worse? I think many habits, particular things like craving, because craving never really gets satisfied, yeah? So if you follow particularly the habits of craving, it tends to kind of get worse and worse and worse as you try to satisfy these things.
So you need things to restrain it, like precepts and that kind of stuff, and it doesn't get worse. And the same thing with the ego is never really satisfied, and the ego always wants more power and wants more, you know, feeling of self-importance and all of these kind of things. So if you allow this thing free reign without any kind of restraint, any kind of rules, it just tends to get worse and worse as a consequence. There's no satisfaction, yeah? And when there's no satisfaction, all of these things kind of drive themselves on and get worse. Thank you for the wonderful teaching. Okay, great. Greed is good is a quote out of the movie Wall Street, made by the main character, Gordon Gekko. Yeah. Yes, but I think actually it was actually said by somebody. I think there was a fellow called Ivan Bosky back in the 1980s on Wall Street that actually said that in real life. He gave a talk at the university or something, and actually told the students this kind of this quote, greed is good. It's a great thing to tell students at the university, just to kind of start them out on the wrong foot in life, so just to make sure everything goes as wrong as possible. But you're quite right, and then that was taken up by this movie, right? And it was actually put into the movie afterwards. So, yeah.
Warum neigen die Gewohnheiten dazu, schlimmer zu werden? Das ist der erste Teil der Frage. Die Gewohnheiten des Verlangens werden schlimmer, weil das Verlangen niemals befriedigt wird. Genauso ist es mit dem Ego. Es möchte immer mehr Macht haben und mehr Bedeutung gewinnen und das wird nie befriedigt werden. Und von daher neigen diese Gewohnheiten dazu, sich selbst zu verstärken, wenn man ihnen keine Grenzen setzt. Vielen Dank für die wunderbaren Unterweisungen. Gier ist gut, ist ein Zitat aus dem Film Wall Street, das von der Filmfigur Gordon Gekko geäußert wird. Und Adam also Ramani sagt, es gibt tatsächlich ein Pendant im richtigen Leben. Das war jemand, der an der Wall Street war und hat an der Uni einen Vortrag gehalten und hat da die Worte gesprochen, Gier ist gut.
Yeah, actually, it's actually interesting. I think there's more of a story about that greed is good in quote, because this fellow who said that, this fellow called Ivan Bosky, he was a Wall Street trader, and you know, they have this list of the kind of the richest people, the one that makes the most money, and this kind of crazy list that they have. And one year, he was on the very bottom of that list. It was kind of 500 people. He was number 500. Yeah? Which actually is really good, because to be number 500, you have to do really, really well, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't be on the list at all. But he was really upset being the last on the list. Apparently, he told his wife, this is the last time you see me on the bottom of this list. It's mad, right? And then, of course, soon after that, he started to do all these dodgy deals. And this is what happened. This is what greed ultimately does to you. You start to do all kind of bad things, insider trading, all of these kind of things. So soon after he said that, this is the last time you see me on the bottom of the list. Soon after that, he was in jail instead. And this is what greed does to you. So greed is good. That was kind of what happened to this fellow there.
Gibt noch eine Geschichte hinter diesem Zitat über diesen Menschen, der das gesprochen hat, Ivan Bosky. Und er war ein Händler an der Wall Street und sie hatten immer so eine Liste der 500 reichsten Leute. Und eines Tages war er die Nummer 500, das heißt, er war der Unterste auf dieser Liste. Das ist schon was Besonderes, wenn man überhaupt auf diese Liste kommt, aber er hat zu seiner Frau gesagt, das wird mir nie mehr passieren, dass ich hier der Unterste bin. Und daraufhin hat er angefangen, alle möglichen dubiosen Geschäfte zu machen und kurz darauf war er dann im Gefängnis.
Okay, dear Master, please don't forget to do the death meditation. So that's been already a short teaching or a longer one. Death is a very important point and also rebirth. And so I have a great idea. Okay. Own retreat on death meditation and rebirth. Thank you. Okay, good. I will keep that in mind. We don't promise anything, but we keep it in mind. Yeah.
Bitte vergiss nicht die Todesbetrachtung und eine kurze Unterweisung oder auch eine längere. Der Tod ist ein sehr wichtiger Punkt, ebenso die Wiedergeburt und deshalb habe ich eine wunderbare Idee, ein eigenes Retreat zum Thema Tod, Todesmeditation und Wiedergeburt. Vielen Dank.
Can you, do you understand that? I can't understand that. What's going on? What's the problem?
In the meta-meditation, then, is meta-meditation an instrument to work with? Will be a person who has passed away.
Passed away, is that what it is?
Trump person.
Ah, okay, that's what it means. Yeah, okay, yeah, so probably someone who's passed away. Okay, good. Thank you very much. That's great to have some decipherers. That's great. So, is it okay to work with somebody who's passed away? To the method after somebody who's passed away? There is apparently a tradition, I think, not sure where it comes from, I think maybe the Visuddhimagga, you're not supposed to have to metta towards people who have passed away. But personally, I can't really see a problem with that. I think that the reason why you're not supposed to have kind of sorrow, kind of pain, the metta meditation, I think that's kind of part of the idea there. But it really depends on the relationship with the person who's passed away. And if you are at ease with it, you don't feel sadness that they have passed away or whatever, you can always have a bit of metta towards them. If that doesn't work, if you actually feel sad about it, then you can do it outside of your ordinary metta meditation, and you can wish them well wherever they are, right? I just wish you well. To do an act of kindness on their behalf, at the same time, I wish you well wherever you may be right now. And that is really enough. That's already sending them some degree of metta right there. To test it out and see if it works, I don't think there is any major problem there.
Okay, ist die Metta-Meditation ein Werkzeug, mit dem man auch in Bezug auf eine verstorbene Person arbeiten kann? Und es gibt eine Tradition, die sagt, man soll das nicht tun, man soll Metta nicht üben in Bezug auf eine verstorbene Person. Wahrscheinlich ist es aus dem Visuddhimagga und womöglich hängt es damit zusammen, dass es einen traurig machen kann, wenn man das probiert. Aber es hängt immer auch von der persönlichen Beziehung ab. Und wenn man sich damit wohlfühlt und nicht sich selbst in einen Zustand der Traurigkeit damit bringt, dann kann man das auch tun. Und wenn das aber nicht so gut funktioniert, dann soll man es besser außerhalb der eigentlichen Meditation tun, einen Akt der Freundlichkeit oder so im Namen der verstorbenen Person und dieser Person einfach alles Gute wünschen. Das kann man immer tun.
Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmāli, would you please tell me the difference between Buddhism as a philosophy and a religion? Thank you. Okay, I personally don't really think Buddhism is a philosophy at all. I think, well, it depends on what you mean by Buddhism. Buddhism is so many different things, right? Everybody has their own Buddhism, so to speak. But if you look at what I would call early Buddhism, which is the suttas, most likely come from the Buddha, the things that we call the EBTs, early Buddhist texts, or basically these four books right here. If you look at that, I would say it's not a philosophy. It's not about building up some kind of structure, some kind of logical understanding of the world. That's not what it is about. Buddhism, if anything, it is like a psychology. It is about learning how to deal with your mind in the right way. It is about overcoming defilement, it is about being wise. It has much more to do with psychology than it has to do with philosophy. But of course, it's more than just ordinary psychology. The sense of religion might perhaps be the fact that it has an ultimate goal. Psychology doesn't really have a goal. Psychology kind of helps you out a little bit to become a bit better or whatever. But Buddhism has a real goal, which is the highest happiness and the ending of all suffering. And maybe that is what you make it into a religion, perhaps. Perhaps. It really depends what you mean by religion. So in one way, it may not be a religion at all. It may just be a path to happiness. It really depends on what you mean by these words and how you define them. So that is, maybe that gives you a little bit of understanding. If not, please try again. Okay, as I'm not too much informed about the Buddhist habit rituals, why do you bow three times every time you sit down for meditation or anything? Okay, so why you bow to dance? It's a bit too much, isn't it? Maybe I should kind of reduce the amount of bowing. You have a point. Sometimes you can bow too much as well. But the idea of bowing is just that you respect something. So when you have a kind of a lot of respect for something, you bow, because it's a nice thing to do when you respect something. And what is it that you respect? Well, you respect the quality that the Buddha represented. So you respect the idea of wisdom, of compassion, of kindness, and all of these kind of things. And if anything in the world is worth bowing down to, it is those things, right? There's so many crazy things we bow down to. We bow down to money, we bow down to all kind of things. Kind of metaphoric, not kind of literally, but metaphorically we bow down to these things. But here are things actually really worth bowing down to. And bowing down is very beautiful. When you bow down to something, you recognize that there are things in the world that are kind of greater than you in a sense. Things that you haven't achieved yet, perhaps that you are aspiring to move towards. And because something is greater than you, something is kind of more than you, then actually it is worthwhile bowing down to that. It kind of reduces your ego a little bit as well at the same time. Actually, it's quite nice to reduce your ego. Yeah, the ego is a pain in the backside sometimes. Always kind of bossing you around and doing kind of crazy things. It's quite nice to have that little bit of humility when you bow down. I would really recommend people to do a bit of bowing, because actually it feels really good. It feels really nice. It's kind of, it's a very positive thing to do that. So please don't feel shy about it. On the other hand, if you feel uncomfortable about it, no need to do it. There's nothing compulsory about this. You bow if you want, you don't bow if you don't want to. So it's kind of very free. And maybe I should bow a bit less. Maybe I bow too much when every time I come in here. It's actually quite a lot. But I'm getting a bit fat in the book. It's a good thing, right? To kind of reduce the weight a little bit. So there is no fixed rule. It's just kind of whatever feels right is really what it's all about. How do I do it the right way? You do it with a good heart. You do it kind of because it feels good, because it feels nice, yeah? Apart from that, there is no right way. You just kind of put your head forward and you bring it up again afterwards, yeah? That's all that is to it. Very, very easy. Can I do it as for respect, even as a new Buddhist? Sure you can. It's a great thing to do for respect. Do I have to do it always? No. Do it just when you want to do it. That is always the right time. Yeah? Okay. Good luck.
Der erste Teil der Frage betrifft den Unterschied zwischen dem Buddhismus als eine Philosophie und als eine Religion. Und das hängt alles sehr davon ab, wie man die einzelnen Begriffe versteht und definiert, sowohl Buddhismus als eben auch Philosophie und Religion. Und jeder hat so auch im Zufall seinen eigenen Buddhismus. Als Philosophie würde ich es überhaupt nicht bezeichnen, denn vor allem gerade die frühen buddhistischen Texte und was im Wesentlichen ist, das, was hier in diesen vier Büchern steht, da geht es überhaupt nicht darum, ein System aufzubauen oder irgendein logisches System, um die Welt zu verstehen. Wenn überhaupt etwas, dann ist der Buddhismus eher eine Psychologie. Es geht darum, dass wir den Geist verstehen, wie der funktioniert. Aber der Buddhismus geht auch über die gewöhnliche Psychologie auch nochmal hinaus. Und das, was er mit einer Religion gemeinsam hat, das ist am ehesten die Tatsache, dass er ein höchstes Ziel hat. Das hat die Psychologie im Prinzip nicht. Aber man kann ihn auch einfach als einen Weg zum Glück bezeichnen. Der nächste Teil der Frage, ich kenne mich nicht so aus über buddhistische Gewohnheiten und Rituale. Warum verbeugt man sich dreimal, jedes Mal, wenn man sich zur Meditation hinsetzt? Und wie tut man es auf die rechte Art? Und kann ich das aus Respekt tun, selbst wenn ich kein Buddhist bin? Und muss ich es jedes Mal tun? Dreimal verbeugen, vielleicht ist dreimal zu viel, vielleicht soll ich es nur dreimal machen. Respekt ist auf jeden Fall etwas, was eine gute Grundlage ist zum Verbeugen. Man drückt damit im Prinzip Respekt aus. Und wovor hat man den Respekt? Vor den guten Qualitäten, die der Buddha verkörpert. auch die Tatsache, dass es etwas gibt, was größer ist als man selbst. Und das ist dann etwas, was es wert ist, dass man sich davor verbeugt. Es hat außerdem die Wirkung, dass es das Ego ein bisschen abbaut, und das ist auch eine gute Sache. Aber wenn man sich damit nicht wohlfühlt, dann muss man es auch nicht tun. Im Wesentlichen geht es bei dem Verbeugen darum, dass es etwas ist, wo man ein Bedürfnis danach hat und dass es der richtige Moment ist zu tun und so, dass man sich damit wohlfühlt. Und die richtige Art, im Prinzip, dass man den Kopf nach vorne und später wieder nach oben, das ist das Wichtigste, und ansonsten geht es wirklich darum, dass man es mit einem guten Herzen macht, einem guten Gefühl im Herzen tut.
Okay. The Adhan, compassion is such a beautiful word, but how do we define a compassionate action? Is it passive, active, or both? Many thanks, sir. So, compassion means that you are motivated by seeing the suffering of other people, or other beings, animals, ghosts, whatever. And when you see the suffering of somebody else, you want to help them. Yeah, that's compassionate action. And when you kind of do that actively, help somebody out, that is what compassion is. So you compassionate action is a bit like you walk on the path and you see the little ants on the path and you think, oh, may the ants be happy. So you walk somewhere else or something like that. Yeah, that's already compassion. Very simple kind of compassion. Or you go to a hospital, you see somebody sick and you cannot help them because you feel compassion for them. They're suffering. Yeah. Whenever you see suffering, or you just listen to a friend who's having trouble, and you just listen to what they have to say to kind of maybe help them a little bit or whatever. All of these things are compassionate actions. You are driven by the motivation to help somebody who is suffering. It can perhaps be passive as well. Usually it would be active, I would say. But it can perhaps be passive. You know the time not to act. That can also be compassionate. But the point is that you're motivated by this feeling of wanting to end or help somebody reduce their suffering.
Das Mitgefühl ist so ein schönes Wort, aber wie definiert man eine mitfühlende Handlung? Ist die passiv, aktiv oder beides? Mitgefühl ist, wenn man davon motiviert ist, dass man das Leiden sieht und helfen möchte. Und gewöhnlich tut man das aktiv. Zum Beispiel sieht man die Ameisen auf dem Weg und man beschließt dann, dass man woanders entlang geht. Oder man geht in ein Krankenhaus und sieht dort das Leiden und empfindet Mitgefühl. Oder man hat einen Freund oder eine Freundin, die Probleme hat, und man redet mit der Person und versucht zu helfen, wo man kann. Manchmal kann es auch eine mitfühlende Handlung auch passiv sein, denn es gibt auch manchmal den Moment, wo es besser ist, nichts zu tun.
Okay, Devante, in which way do you recommend to read the suttas? In a certain sequence, before or after daily meditation, do you know of a list that shows which sutta is about which dhamma, which aspect of the teaching? Thanks a lot. Okay, so certain sequence, not necessarily. I think I mentioned this the other day, but there's a book by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi called In the Buddha's Words, which actually is a very nice introduction, because it groups the suttas according to topics. And then it has explanatory notes on the end, and it has introductions at the beginning, which kind of gives you a very nice way of getting access to the suttas. That is quite a nice way of doing it. Otherwise, you can pretty much open any sutta. You can take the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the red one here, the middle length sayings. You can open it up at random and choose any sutta and start reading it. Actually, there is in this book here, there is a summary of each sutta at the very beginning. It gives you like a two-line summary of the sutta. So if it sounds interesting, you can kind of go to that sutta. Most of the suttas tend to be self-contained. Remember, the Buddha was speaking to the bhikkhus or the bhikkhunis or the lay people on a particular occasion. So because of that, each sutta is really self-contained. It's a teaching in its own right. So usually every sutta has a meaning without necessarily needing that much context. So that's why you can read almost anywhere. Before or after daily meditation, it depends, whatever you feel like it. If the sutta makes you peaceful and it kind of leads you towards meditation, then read it beforehand. If it makes you agitated because it's kind of too much philosophy or whatever, really afterwards. Yeah, whatever works, basically. That's really, really the trick here. Yeah. Do you know of a list that shows about which Dhamma, etc., which aspect of the teachings? The best thing then would be to, again, to go in a Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, which actually has these things kind of systematized, yeah? So you have kind of each, the suttas are grouped together according to topics in the word, in the Buddha's word, so. Okay.
Auf welche Art ist es empfehlenswert, die Suttas zu lesen, in einer bestimmten Reihenfolge, vor oder nach der täglichen Meditation? Und gibt es eine Liste, die die zeigt, welches Sutta, welchen Aspekt des Dhammas vermittelt? Und oder welchen Aspekt der Lehre? Es ist nicht notwendigerweise, dass man die Suttas in einer bestimmten Reihenfolge lesen muss. Eine gute Möglichkeit ist, dass, was ich schon empfohlen habe, Bhikkhu Bodhis Buch in den Worten des Buddha. Das ist eine übersichtliche Struktur, wo die Sutten nach Themen gruppiert sind, und das ist ein guter Zugang. Ansonsten kann man auch einfach nach dem Zufallsprinzip ein Sutta auswählen, zum Beispiel aus dem Majjhima Nikaya. Übrigens haben diese gibt es am Anfang im Majjhima Nikaya zu jedem Sutta eine kleine Zusammenfassung von 2 Zeilen, die einem schon mal einen guten Überblick geben kann. Und jedes Sutta steht im Prinzip für sich selber und muss nicht unbedingt in einem Kontext gelesen werden. Vor oder nach der täglichen Meditation, das kommt darauf an, wie das für jede Person funktioniert. Wenn man vom Lesen der Suttas ruhig und friedlich wird, ist es gut, es vorher zu machen. Wenn man davon eher aufgeregt wird, weil es so philosophisch ist und man dann ins Nachdenken kommt, dann lieber hinterher. Und eine Liste, da ist nochmal eben dieses Buch von Bhikkhu Bodhi sehr geeignet.
Okay, Devante, I find it quite difficult to get the thinking along the Buddhist terms into process. Do you have any advice? Thanks a lot. So, how to kind of get started with thinking in a Buddhist way? You're thinking kind of contemplating teaching, perhaps. And one way of doing that is just to read the suttas, right? You read the sutta that you're enjoying, and you pause every now and again, and you ask yourself, what does this actually mean? What does it mean in a kind of philosophical way? What does it mean in a practical way? How do I apply this in my life? What do I do with it? How does it fit with everything else? You stop, you think, wow, this is interesting. If it's boring, just forget about it and move on to something else. And think about that instead. Maybe you come across something that looks kind of exciting or looks useful or whatever. Stop, think about it. What does it really mean? And this way you can get these things into process. Or you're just walking back and forth on your walking path outside, and then something comes into your mind. You just allow things to be. You don't think about anything, but something comes into your mind from reading the suttas. And you think, if it comes into your mind, it usually means it's important to you. So you think, well, what does this mean? What is going on here? And you reflect, you kind of think about it in that sense. And as you do that, you kind of come to accept these teachings. And this is really what it's all about. It's kind of internalizing them, making them become part of you. So kind of your outlook, your way of looking at the world becomes shaped by the suttas. You kind of steering your view in the right direction. Or you can just take a theme, like death, right? And you can kind of think about death. So you walk back and forth, and you ask yourself, what does it feel like if I, I'm never going to leave this retreat center here? Maybe this is the last thing I do in my life. What does it feel like? And you walk back and forth. What does it feel like if you're never going to go back home, never going to do all of those things again, never going to see all those people you normally see? It's a little bit like the death contemplation we're doing now, but a little bit different because you're walking back and forth. And you feel what that feels like. But it's like using a reflection to, in a Buddhist way of thinking. Something like that.
Ich finde es schwierig, in die Denkweise hineinzufinden, also dass man in buddhistischen Begriffen denkt. Gibt es dafür einen Rat? Ein guter Rat, um in die buddhistische Denkweise hineinzukommen, ist es, die Suttas zu lesen und wenn man etwas liest, sich dann zu fragen, was bedeutet das, sowohl in philosophischer als auch in praktischer Hinsicht. Und vor allem dann, wenn eine Stelle interessant erscheint, dass man dann einfach stoppt und mal darüber nachdenkt, was das bedeutet. Oder man tut es während der Gehmeditation, wenn einem etwas in den Sinn kommt, eine Stelle aus dem Suttas, dass man die dann aufgreift und darüber nachdenkt. Und wenn man das allmählich tut, dann verinnerlicht man diese Dinge immer mehr und gewinnt eine Akzeptanz und die werden zum Teil zu einem Teil von einem selbst. Oder sie werden praktisch die Perspektive, aus der man etwas betrachtet. Oder man kann ein Thema aufgreifen, wie zum Beispiel den Tod, und kann das auch bei der Gehmeditation betrachten und kann sich fragen, wie fühlt sich das an? Wie wäre das, wenn ich jetzt von diesem Retreat nicht mehr nach Hause käme? Was habe ich da innerlich für ein Gefühl dazu? Das ist auch eine andere Möglichkeit.
Okay, so here is the same question pretty much again, how to contemplate something here. Thank you very much, dear myself here. So again, similar kind of thing, right? Maybe one nice thing to add that I didn't say before is that when you do the death contemplation here, then feel what it feels like. If you're going to die, like before you meet anyone else, before you go back home or whatever, what does that feel like? Are you ready for that? Yeah, do you feel that when you think like that, do you feel that you have some kind of regret or something? That there's somebody you really should speak to before you die? Are you ready to say goodbye to everyone or not? If you don't feel ready to say goodbye to everyone, then you know that there is something there that you need to work out. You need to talk to them, you need to kind of say sorry, or you need to kind of, whatever it is, it's something that you need to sort out in your life. This is one of the advantages of the death contemplation. It makes you feel whether you are ready for this or not. What are the things that stop you? What other mental blockages you have? And then it gives you this chance to sort things out before it's too late. So death contemplation is a good one to do. Contemplate the sutta is a good thing to do. Metta is good to do. Who are the people in this world you're having problems with? Yeah? Where is it hard to, how can you look at those people in a different way? Walk back and forth. What are the good qualities of these people? Write down in your mind all the good qualities. Throw out all the bad ones. And then store those inside. So when you meet them next time, you can bring them out to kind of look at them in a different way. All of these things are contemplations you can do, especially when you walk in. But even when you're sitting, you can do some of these things.
Die Frage ist nochmal so ähnlich wie kontempliert man etwas. Und ich könnte noch etwas hinzufügen, zum Beispiel wenn man die Todesbetrachtung macht, dass man sich fragt, wie fühlt es sich an, wenn ich jetzt mir vorstelle, ich komme gar nicht mehr nach Hause, treffe meine Angehörigen und Freunde nicht mehr und muss vorher sterben. Gibt es da irgendetwas, was man bedauert? Gibt es jemanden, mit dem man noch etwas zu klären hätte? Und das ist auch eine gute Gelegenheit, zu der uns diese Todesbetrachtung helfen kann, dass wir sehen, was es noch zu klären gibt und dass wir die Chance haben, das noch zu tun, bevor es zu spät ist. Und gute Themen sind eben der Tod, aber auch Metta, die guten Qualitäten anderer Menschen und so weiter, um solche Betrachtungen anzustellen.
Okay, how does a Buddhist deal with parasites like ticks and fleas and worms? To get rid of them, you have to kill them. But that is not right. Thank you. Yes, so we try our very best to avoid killing even parasites. So, if you have a tick, for example, in Australia, they have lots of ticks everywhere. But they don't have any viruses. They're not very dangerous. So even if they bite you, it's not a big issue. But then once it kind of gets stuck inside of you, and you always have some ticks stuck inside of you, you pull them out carefully. And when you pull them out carefully, you chuck them back in the forest and they kind of find some poor kangaroo instead. There's always a downside, right? Somebody's going to have to suffer it, unfortunately. Yeah, that's kind of the way the world works. So you just try your very best to deal with these things without kind of killing them. sometimes you can use sprays that repel these things, so they don't actually die, they just repel them. Yeah? This is a nice way of doing it. And if you get worms, intestinal worms, that is a more of a major problem. In those cases, sometimes you have to kill them. There's not much choice, because there's just too much problems if you don't actually kill them. So there are situations where you kind of say, okay, what am I going to do now? There isn't much option really. And then you end up killing them after all. Like especially things like intestinal worms, I think it is usually recommended, unless it is not a big issue for you. Sometimes there are also kind of all kinds of pests that you can get in your house and all of these kind of things. And you try your very best to find an outcome. Right? Sometimes you have cockroaches in your kitchen. Yeah, if you are like an establishment, you have a restaurant and there's cockroaches in the kitchen, then sometimes you have to do something, otherwise the authorities come and they shut down your whole kitchen. Yeah, this, that kind of stuff. But sometimes it's almost as if you are trapped and there's a kind of, whatever you do, it is wrong. So you try your very best. And by trying your very best, by finding alternative ways of dealing with the problem, you're minimizing the bad karma if you are forced to do something about it. So always try your best to find an alternative solution. If there is no alternative solution, you kind of, sometimes you have to do things that are not absolutely ideal. But at the very least, you don't have anger against these things, right? And you realize you're doing it because of not much choice in the matter.
Wie geht ein Buddhist mit Parasiten um, wie Zecken, Fliegen oder Würmern? Um sie loszuwerden, muss man sie töten, aber das ist eigentlich nicht richtig. Wir versuchen auf jeden Fall unser Bestes, sie nicht zu töten. Mit Zecken ist das so, in Australien gibt es jede Menge Zecken und wir haben die ständig in der Haut, aber die haben keine die übertragen keine Krankheiten, so ist es an sich nicht so tragisch und wir ziehen die aus der Haut einfach raus, werfen sie wieder in den Wald und dann sind die armen Kängurus nachher die Leidtragenden. Einen trifft leider immer. Aber wir versuchen unser Bestes. Mit Würmern im Darm ist es nochmal eine andere Sache. Da wird es wohl oft nicht anders gehen, als dass man sie tatsächlich umbringt, um sie loszuwerden. Man versucht eine andere Lösung zu finden, aber manchmal gibt es Situationen, da gibt es keine andere Lösung. Genauso ist es mit Ungeziefer im Haus. Zum Beispiel Cockroaches, ich glaube Kakerlaken ist das. Wenn die in der Küche sind und wenn man zum Beispiel ein Restaurant oder sowas hat, dann kommt das Gesundheitsamt und will einen den Laden schließen. Da muss man etwas unternehmen. Manchmal ist man in einer Situation, wo egal was man tut, es irgendwie nicht hundertprozentig richtig ist. Und man versucht, das schlechte Karma zu minimieren, soweit es geht. Und das Mindeste, was man tun kann, ist, dass man gegen diese Wesen keinen Hass aufbaut, sondern dass man es einfach tut, weil es keinen anderen Weg gibt.
Okay. How to reduce the sensual desire naturally? It seems like a goal far away. We are born already with the five senses to enjoy the worldly pleasures. There are so many things pleasurable in this world. Okay. Yes. Indeed, there are lots of pleasurable things, this kind of food, that kind of food, all these kind of things. So how do you do it naturally? Well, you see the danger in them. You see the problem, you see the disadvantage, and you see the advantage of other happinesses, right, that are even greater than the sensual happinesses. This is how you do it. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to talk about sensual pleasures, right? So all morning, 1 hour, I'm going to kind of bang, I'm going to really force it on you. So actually it's quite nice, because we're going to look at tomorrow as mostly similes, and they're kind of wise reflections on how to move away from these things without forcing ourselves, but doing it naturally. So yes, there are many enjoyable things in the world, but there are things even more enjoyable than that, right? This is kind of the point here. Number two, how to let go of the doer, or the thinker, or the mind naturally. Thank you. So you let go of the doer in meditation, right? You do the meditation practice, and as you calm down, you become more peaceful. The doer is already disappearing a little bit. And you see, wow, doer is gone. So nice. Yeah, you can't. Actually, the doer is a pain in the backside. So you can be so happy when the doer is gone. So this is about looking at things in the right way. So you think, whoa, this is really nice, and the doer is gone. And then you get an impetus towards reducing the doer even more. And your meditation gets even more peaceful, and you think even better. And then it kind of goes on like that, stage after stage. The thinker and the doer are pretty much the same thing. So if you can let go of the doer, you're also letting go of the thinker. Letting go of the entire mind, naturally, that's a bit of a, that's a long way down the track. But it's all about insight and understanding. It's all about seeing things as being a problem. So, yeah, if the less mind there is, the more happy you are. Then you kind of get into the habit of letting go of the mind as well. Until one day, poof, it is completely gone. And you achieve the highest happiness as a consequence. Okay.
Die Frage hat zwei Teile. Wie kann man das sinnliche Verlangen auf natürliche Art reduzieren? Es erscheint wie ein sehr fernes Ziel. Wir werden schon mit den fünf Sinnen geboren, um die weltlichen Genüsse zu genießen. Und es gibt so viele angenehme Dinge in dieser Welt. Man kann das reduzieren, indem man die Gefahr in den sinnlichen Genüssen sieht und auch und zum anderen, indem man eben sieht, dass es andere Genüsse gibt, die höher und größer sind und besser sind. Und morgen früh wird es um dieses Thema gehen mit ganz vielen Gleichnissen, wie das auf ganz natürliche Art geschieht. Der zweite Teil der Frage, wie kann man den Macher loslassen oder den Denker oder den Geist auf natürliche Art. Den Macher lässt man in der Meditation los. Wenn die Meditation friedlich wird, dann wird er schon ein bisschen kleiner und das fühlt sich sehr schön an. Und das gibt einem dann den Impuls, das noch weiter zu reduzieren und so verstärkt sich das immer weiter. Und der Denker ist mehr oder weniger das Gleiche wie der Macher. Dass man den ganzen Geist loslässt, dazu braucht es einen weiten Weg, aber am Ende, irgendwann ist es dann vielleicht so weit, dass man den loslassen kann. Je weniger Geist, umso größer das Glück und irgendwann kommt der Punkt vielleicht, wo man das komplett loslassen kann und hat das allerhöchste Glück dann.
Okay, Dr. Adam, could you please indicate the sutras which seem to give flexibility in keeping sila, the five precepts for lay people, as you briefly mentioned yesterday? Thank you very much. So, the sutras I'm talking about is a sutra which shows you what really good karma and bad karma is all about. So this is a sutra called Roots, Mula in Pali. And it shows you, like, if you like the final analysis of what actually is good and bad karma. So this is how the sutta goes. This is in the Anguttara 3, number 69 is this particular sutta. And this is what it sounds like. Whatever greed occurs, bhikkhus, is unwholesome. Actually, let's go to anger. Whatever hatred occurs is unwholesome. Whatever deed a person full of hate performs by body, speech, and mind is also unwholesome. When a person full of hate, overcome by hatred, with mind obsessed by it, inflicts suffering upon another under a false pretext by killing, imprisonment, confiscation, censure, banishment, thinking, I am powerful, I want power, or whatever, that too is unwholesome. Thus, numerous bad, unwholesome qualities originate in him, born of hatred, caused by hatred, arisen from hatred, conditioned by hatred. And then there's the opposite. Whatever non-hatred occurs is unwholesome. Whatever deed one without hate performs by body, speech, and mind is also wholesome. Yeah, if you have no hate, if you have no greed, if you have no delusion, the act is wholesome by definition. It is wholesome. When one without hate, not overcome by hate, with mind not obsessed by it, does not inflict suffering upon another, under a false pretext, etc. Just as in the previous example, all that too is wholesome. Thus, the numerous wholesome qualities originate in him, born of non-hatred, caused by non-hatred, arisen from non-hatred, conditioned by non-hatred. So anything which is originated by non-hatred, non-greed, and non-delusion, that by definition is wholesome according to the suttas. And this is, if you like, this is a kamma, or this is ethics in the kind of the final analysis, what it comes down to, is the thing, the motivating force that drives your actions. Anguttara Parisa, number 69.
Okay. Die Frage geht dahin, in welchem Sutta diese flexible Herangehensweise an die Silas beschrieben wird. Zum Beispiel die fünf Ethikregeln für Laienpraktizierende. So wie es hier jetzt schon mehrfach erwähnt worden ist. Und das Sutta, auf das Asanthamani sich bezieht, ist im Anguttara Nikaya, die Nummer 3, also in dem Dreierkapitel, die Nummer 69. Und es geht um das gute und schlechte Karma. Und wenn ich das ganz kurz zusammenfasse, dann beschreibt es einfach, dass der Hass, wenn er in jemandem besteht, unheilsam ist und jede Handlung, die von Hass motiviert ausgeführt wird, ist unheilsam und auch wenn man jemandem schadet unter einem falschen Vorwand und ist von Hass motiviert, dann sind diese Dinge alle unheilsam. Und das Gegenteil, wenn jemand frei von Hass ist, ist das ein heilsamer Zustand und jede Handlung, die frei von Hass ausgeführt wird, ist eine heilsame Handlung und auch wenn und wenn frei von Hass man nicht unter falschem Vorwand irgendwelche Dinge tut, die anderen schaden, ist das auch etwas Heilsames. Das heißt, die Motivation, ob man jetzt von Gier, Hass oder Verblendung motiviert ist oder eben vom jeweiligen Gegenteil, das ist das Ausschlaggebende für die Qualität der Handlung.
Okay. I'm not sure if I understand this exactly right, but can you read that word over there? Can you see what it says?
Which word?
this one over here.
Anything. In context. Generosity, how far should one help another person? Another person cannot just I don't know.
Okay, never mind. I think we'll get it anyway. So, okay. So how far should one help another person? Another person cannot just something that they need help. He sees you as a person who could help him out in certain ways and support him. I try to help him as much as I can. I practice meditation, relax myself and set boundaries. But many times I feel like he is coming too close to my territory. I cannot help him as much as he needs and wants. I feel uncomfortable. How can I solve the situation? Yeah, so this is the thing. There's only so much you can do for other people, right? And the main thing we do for others is just to be generally kind. And if somebody becomes kind of dependent on you, that's also not a good situation, right? You are kind, but they become dependent, and it creates this kind of conflict very quickly. That is not ideal. So if they become dependent, it's good to kind of create a bit of boundaries again and a bit of distance, and to kind of so that know to look after themselves. They have, in the end, they have to take responsibility for their own lives. And you cannot kind of sort out all the problems in somebody else's life. So it's a very good point. There is a kind of a distinction between being helpful and being kind of clingy and kind of being too dependent on each other. So do what you can, and when you feel that situation arises, keep a bit distance again, so that they understand that there are very clear boundaries there. And then you will be doing the right thing. A lot of the time, we cannot do all that much to help other people. Usually they have to want to help themselves and sort out their own lives. We can't really sort out the lives of other people. But what we can do very often, more than helping them, is to be a good example and show them the way through our example. That's often more powerful than actually the help we can give them. Someone who just comes to you for a teaching, that's the kind of the ideal thing. But they come for you some advice, right? And you give them advice, and then they act upon that. That is really the right way of helping them. If helping means a constant kind of support to hold them up, then usually it gets too much. Something like that. But it's not always easy.
Es geht um die Grundsätzlichkeit, wie weit kann man gehen, um jemand anderem zu helfen? I see, he cannot sustain himself. Jemand anders kommt selbst nicht klar und braucht Hilfe. Er sieht einen als einen Mensch, der ihm helfen könnte, ihn auf bestimmte Art oder ihn unterstützen könnte. Und ich versuche, ihm soweit als möglich, soweit ich kann, zu helfen. Ich übe die Meditation, entspanne mich und setze Grenzen. Aber oft fühlt es sich für mich so an, als käme er zu nah in mein Gebiet und ich kann ihm nicht so viel helfen, wie er das bräuchte oder wie er es wollte. Und ich fühle mich damit unwohl. Wie kann ich diese Situation lösen? Ja, man kann immer nur mit seiner Hilfe bis zu einem bestimmten Punkt gehen und kann dann irgendwann auch nicht mehr tun. Außer, dass man generell freundlich zu jemandem ist. Aber wenn jemand abhängig wird von einem, dann ist das kein guter Zustand und es ist wichtig, eine Grenze zu setzen und ein bisschen Abstand zu schaffen. Und jeder muss auch für sein eigenes Leben selber die Verantwortung übernehmen. Und oft ist es auch so, dass man eigentlich gar nicht so viel tun kann. Und man kann nicht alle Probleme im Leben der anderen Person lösen. Manchmal ist es sehr viel wirkungsvoller, wenn man einfach ein gutes Beispiel gibt. Wenn jemand kommt und um Rat bittet und man erteilt einen Rat und die Person handelt danach, dann ist es eine gute Sache. Aber wenn die Person haben möchte, dass man immer und ständig für sie tätig wird, dann ist das nicht ganz die richtige Art.
Okay, so next one. What is the Buddha's perspective on ending a marriage after trying to make it work for many years, as the differences could not be sorted out? It's okay, you can end, you know, there's no problem from Buddha's point of view to end a marriage if it is difficult, it doesn't work out, and whatever, if you have tried your very best. It's always useful to try, first of all, of course. And sometimes the very effort of trying to sort things out, you learn so much through that process. Too often we run away too fast, we lose an opportunity very often to actually grow spiritually. So take the opportunity first. If it still doesn't work out, then it becomes a point when it's perfectly okay to have a divorce or whatever. These things are not kind of necessarily bad in themselves. If you are incompatible, you don't belong together, you probably should divorce, right? Are you then bound to meet a person or a partner afterwards who has the same problems, the same topics, or can you work on those things and find someone where it could work better? No, you are not bound to meet someone who has the same problems, right? This is like determinism, kind of your karma is to meet that kind of person. You meet exactly that kind of person all the time. But karma doesn't really work like that. Karma is not that specific. There are all kinds of people out there, and you might meet a worse one, right? You just never know. It's very uncertain what's going to happen next. Maybe you meet a better one. They're both possibilities. So karma is not deterministic. I think this is one of the big misunderstandings in the world about the karma, is that it is deterministic. Kind of everything you experience in the world is because of karma. It's not like that. Karma is more, gives you a general framework. You become reborn as a human being. The reason why you are human is because of karma. But then what happens in that human life is like, well, if you're human, you can expect certain things. You can expect your marriage not to work out. You can expect to have a nice job. You can expect to get fired. You can expect to break a leg. You can expect to go on a meditation retreat. All these things you can expect within human life. They're not due to karma. They're just due to what happens to human beings. So the mistake you made was getting reborn as a human in the first place. That was a mistake, right? Once you are there, these things happen as a consequence. Okay, see what happens.
Wie ist die buddhistische Perspektive über das Beenden einer Ehe. Nachdem man für viele Jahre versucht hat, es irgendwie hinzukriegen. Und die Unterschiede konnten nicht überwunden werden. Ist man danach dazu verurteilt, nochmal jemanden zu finden, der dieselben Probleme hat und dieselben Themen, oder kann man daran arbeiten und dann jemand finden, mit dem es besser funktioniert? Das Beenden einer Ehe ist im Buddhismus nicht als solches ein Problem. Man sollte auf jeden Fall sein Bestes versuchen. Und häufig ist es so, dass die Leute zu schnell aufgeben oder weglaufen. Dieser Prozess, es zu versuchen, kann einen sehr viel lehren und kann sehr fruchtbar sein. Aber wenn es tatsächlich nicht funktioniert, dann ist das eine Trennung oder eine Scheidung nicht als solches ein Problem. Dass man dazu verurteilt ist, nochmal eine Person mit denselben Problemen zu finden, nein, das ist nicht der Fall. Das klingt sehr nach Determinismus, aber das ist nicht die Art, wie das Karma funktioniert. Es gibt so viele verschiedene Menschen auf der Welt und man könnte vielleicht sogar jemanden treffen, mit dem es noch schlechter geht. Oder eben auch besser, das kann alles sein. Das Karma ist nicht so, dass jedes einzelne Ereignis, das uns widerfährt, jetzt vom Karma bestimmt wird. Wir werden als Menschen geboren, weil wir ein bestimmtes Karma haben. Und dann gibt es verschiedene Dinge, die man als Mensch erwarten kann. Und die müssen nicht unbedingt mit einem bestimmten Karma zusammenhängen. Der Fehler, den wir gemacht haben, war erst schon mal, dass wir als Mensch überhaupt geboren wurden. Und das andere kommt dann automatisch mit.
Okay. Okay, so next one. Dear Adam, please talk a bit about the teacher-disciple relationship in Theravada Buddhism. And how is your spiritual development influenced by whom? The retreat comes to an end. I'll be happy to learn in your presence more about the Dhamma. Devandrumali, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so teacher-disciple relationship, the idea is not to, you don't really need a very close relationship with a teacher, yeah? What you have is a relationship which is fairly kind of, you learn from somebody, it doesn't have to be very personal in a sense. This, I think, is the ideal thing. So if you ask me who are my teachers in Buddhism, well, obviously Ajahn Brahm, right? He's obviously kind of my main teacher, and that is because I always found him very inspiring, but he's also very kind of aloof, right? You don't have a personal relationship with him, really. He's your teacher, and that's it. Yeah, I've been living with him for 21 years, and you never really... You never have a close relationship with him. He just doesn't like that. He's kind of very aloof. And I think that's a good thing. Because if you want to be a teacher and you want to have some effect, you need a bit of distance to people who consider themselves your students or whatever. So who apart from that? I think Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi I would consider a teacher because he has... I learned a lot from him in the early days by reading his translations and reading some of his books and that kind of stuff. And he was very, very kind of influential as well. And of course, the number one teacher is the Buddha. Yeah, the number one. Even he, is, in the end, the Buddha I consider my real teacher on this path. And as far, you know, if I feel anyone contradicts the word of the Buddha, I will argue with them. This is to Ajahn Brahm's kind of, you know, despair. it's not that bad. I'm exaggerating anything. Because that is where I find the kind of final authority in these things. This is how I work with things. So take the Buddha as your final teacher. It's actually much, much safer that way because having a close student-teacher relationship is not really all that advisable, I think, to have a kind of distant one. And if you like the way I teach, you can always listen to the YouTube videos. There's plenty of YouTube videos available until you get utterly, thoroughly sick of me, and then you can move on to the next teacher after that. Take one teacher at a time. And there's lots of good teachings in this way. But come back to the suttas. Take the Buddha as your main teacher. That is what I would recommend. Okay.
Die Frage betrifft die Lehrer-Schüler-Beziehung im Theravada-Buddhismus. Ähm, Ah, und die Frage ist, wie Adam Brahmanis eigene spirituelle Entwicklung von den Lehrern geprägt worden ist. Das Retreat geht zu Ende. Ich würde gerne mehr in deiner Gegenwart lernen über den Dhamma. Lieber Adam Brahmani, Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. Die Lehrer-Schüler-Beziehung ist nicht unbedingt eine sehr persönliche Beziehung. Meine persönlichen Lehrer, also natürlich Adam Brahm, allerdings muss ich sagen, er ist auch sehr distanziert auf eine Art und die Beziehung ist nicht sehr persönlich. Es ist nie eine nahe Beziehung. Und das ist einfach seine Art und es ist auch sicher eine gute Sache, dass es einen gewissen Abstand gibt zu den Leuten, die man als Schüler hat. Ein anderer Lehrer für mich ist Vico Bodhi gewesen, vor allem am Anfang, als ich sehr viel gelernt habe, indem ich seine Übersetzungen und seine Schriften gelesen habe. Und der Lehrer Nummer 1 ist natürlich immer der Buddha. Das ist für mich die letzte Autorität. Und wenn jemand dem widerspricht, dann würde ich auch dagegen argumentieren. Und es ist auf jeden Fall sicherer, ihn als Lehrer zu nehmen. Und wenn jemand meine Art zu lehren gefällt, da gibt es ganz viele YouTube-Videos im Internet und wenn man irgendwann die Nase davon voll hat, dann kann man die Videos von einem anderen Lehrer anschauen. Also es gibt viele, viele Sachen, aber am besten ist es immer wieder auf die Sutras zurückzukommen.
Okay, so the last question for tonight. The other Ramana is still pondering on the topic of breaking precepts out of compassion. Okay, so I'm just talking about this one just very briefly before I move on to the rest of your thing here. And when we talk about breaking a precept out of compassion, one of the things to understand about that is that you have to, it's not about compassion to some people and not to others. Everybody has to be included in that compassion. Maybe that's why people get confused, because you think that if you have compassion for these people, you can do something bad to somebody else. But that is not the point. The point is that the compassion has to include everybody. Yeah, and because compassion includes everybody here, that kind of limits what you can do in those kind of situations. It means that if there is one very bad serial killer arising in the world, yeah, and he's going to kill 100 people, and you know that, well, it doesn't mean that you have compassion for those 100, but not for the serial killer. You have compassion for all of them, including the serial killer here. And that means that you can't even go out and kill that serial killer, probably, to save all of those other people. So it is a very broad idea of compassion. It's not narrowed on a few people. It has to include everyone. That means that it's not a kind of an escape route to do nasty things towards some people at all, because it is very broad in this sense. Okay, please help. Consciousness is the condition and nutriment for nama rupa, name and form. Madhyamalikaya 38:26. Page 358, okay. But when there is the union of mother and father, the mother is in the seed, and the Gandhava is present. Okay, yes. Now the question. What is the Gandhava? Okay, so what this sutta says, and it says that the three things have to kind of be right for there to be kind of the rising of a new being in the womb, right? And the thing is that the mother and father coming together, the mother being the right seed, and the Gandhava has to be there. And this particular way of looking at this, the rising of a new being, seems to be a Brahmanical way that existed in India prior to the Buddha. And you can see that if you read one of the suttas later in the Majjhimanikaya, where this idea is specifically said to be Brahmanical. This is probably not such a Buddhist idea. It's something that the Buddha probably took on board because it is accurate enough, but it's not to be taken too literally to mean that these three things have to occur at exactly the same time. Yeah, and that, I think, is where the problem arises. There is a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of evidence to show that very often the Gandhava, or the stream of consciousness, actually arises somewhat later. It can arise fairly late in the pregnancy, when the embryo is already quite large. Yeah, it doesn't have to happen straight away. Because this passage here seems to say, and I know this passage very well, seems to say that the embryo, the consciousness, arrives pretty much straight away. So the Gandhava in this particular case is just that. It's just a stream of consciousness arriving from a past life. And Gandhava was a term that was used at that time in the Brahmanical tradition to describe that stream of consciousness arriving from the past. And that's why it's given that particular name. So in otherwise, of course, Gandhava otherwise also means heavenly musician, but obviously it doesn't mean heavenly musician in this case. Someone's playing the when you get a pregnant, someone's playing like a nice flute or something. Yeah. And oh, somebody's being born. Actually, sorry, I missed out a lot of the question, actually. It continues on the second side. Okay, I better do that as well then. Okay, so one, who is the Gandhava? Two, conclusion of what? I lost you now. The Gandhava is present. So what happens, you mean? Then? Okay, yes, that is when you have a successful, somebody arrives in the womb and somebody actually starts a new life. Yeah, that's what it means. That's quite right. So the question then is exactly when that consciousness actually comes into play here. It also comes to mind what Tanajan Mahabua used to tell after he had entered his mother's womb. He did not stay there the whole time. When he was abroad, his mother thought, the unborn died, okay? But when he returned, and his energetic, with an energetic character, there was not for the mother, the unborn is alive, boxing in my belly. Okay, he was a boxer before he became a monk as a Mahabua, so probably he was kind of practicing here. thank you for your patience. Okay. Yes, that's it, right? And this is the thing, is that there are so many of these kind of stories, anecdotal stories about, you know, the consciousness arising quite late in the pregnancy, maybe departing again, and then kind of re-arising. There are lots of these kind of stories that I am very reluctant to interpret that particular passage in Madhyamanikaya 38 to mean that the consciousness has to arise from the very beginning. Specifically, when I see that this is taken from another tradition, is not the purely Buddhist kind of view. It's something the Buddhists took on board because it was close enough to give an idea of what was going on. But it does not seem to mean, I don't think it actually means that. And so this is one example, but there are many, many examples like this of consciousness, it seems, arriving not at the very beginning of a pregnancy. So, and sometimes we have to take this anecdotal evidence seriously, because if a lot of people have this evidence, it comes from people who are believable, who are trustworthy, then it's very hard to dismiss it as nonsense. And so this is it. So yeah, so that's a good question, and I think precisely, and that is really the best I can do in answering that, I think. Yeah.
Geht hier nochmal um das Thema, dass man Ethikregeln aus Mitgefühl bricht. Und Ajahn Chammali sagt, es ist ganz wichtig, dass in dieses Mitgefühl jeder eingeschlossen ist. Und dann gibt es schon Grenzen dessen, was man tun kann. Wenn zum Beispiel ein Massenmörder da ist und man weiß, der wird jetzt 100 Menschen umbringen, dann wird es nicht zum Ziel führen, wenn man Mitgefühl für die 100 potenziellen Opfer hat und dann nicht für diesen Massenmörder, sondern man muss für alle das Mitgefühl haben. Und dann kann man auch schon nicht hingehen und seinerseits den Massenmörder töten. Bewusstsein ist die Bedingung und das die Nahrung für Namarupa, Madhyamanikaya 38, 26, Seite 358, und wenn es die Verbindung von Mutter und Vater, wenn die Verbindung von Mutter und Vater da ist und die Mutter in der richtigen Zeit ist und der Sandarbha ist auch da, erstens, wer oder was ist der Gandhaba? Ja, das ist so, dass es in diesem Sutra so beschrieben ist, dass drei Dinge zusammenkommen müssen, damit ein neues Lebewesen entsteht. Und das ist die brahmanische Art, diesen Vorgang zu erklären, so wie es auch schon vor der Zeit des Buddha in Indien üblich war, in der brahmanischen Tradition. Und das geht aus einem anderen Sutta im Majjhima Nikaya vor, wo darauf hingewiesen wird, dass das aus der brahmanischen Tradition stammt. Der Buddha hat es wohl so übernommen, weil es präzise genug ist, um die ganze Sache zu beschreiben, aber man darf es nicht zu wörtlich nehmen. Der Bewusstseinsstrom kann auch später in einer Schwangerschaft in den Mutterleib eintreten. Gandhava bedeutet einfach dieser Bewusstseinsstrom. Und der Begriff kommt aus der brahmanischen Tradition. Und das Wort kann auch eben ein himmlischer Musikant bedeuten, aber das ist in diesem Fall ist das nicht die Bedeutung. Dann die zweite Frage, was ist die Schlussfolgerung daraus? Die Schlussfolgerung ist, dass eben auf diese Art ein neues Leben entsteht. Und dann kommt noch eine Anekdote. Es fällt mir auch jetzt ein, eine Geschichte, die Asan Mahabua öfter erzählt hat, nachdem er selber in den Leib seiner Mutter eingetreten war, ist er da nicht die ganze Zeit geblieben. Und wenn er weg war, dachte seine Mutter, das ungeborene Kind ist gestorben. Und wenn er wieder zurück war, mit seinem energetischen Charakter, dann dann war es keine Frage für seine Mutter, dass das Kind am Leben war und hat in ihrem Bauch geboxt. Und offenbar war er ein Boxer, bevor er Mönch geworden ist. Und hat schon während der Schwangerschaft geübt. Es gibt viele ähnliche Geschichten, die nahelegen, dass das Bewusstsein erst zu einem späteren Zeitpunkt der Schwangerschaft eintritt in den Mutterleib. Und auch, dass es möglicherweise zwischendurch wieder verschwindet. Und deswegen bin ich ein bisschen zurückhaltend mit dieser einen Stelle, vor allem, weil die eben auch aus einer anderen Tradition und nicht aus der buddhistischen, nicht vom Buddha direkt kommt, dass ich die so interpretiere, dass das Bewusstsein unbedingt direkt am Anfang der Schwangerschaft da sein muss. Und manchmal muss man solche Anekdoten auch ernst nehmen. Und das ist das Beste, was ich zu dem Thema sagen kann.
Okay, so it's organized. So have a nice rest again and we'll see you again tomorrow morning. Let's just do the Allahan together.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang